Welcome to The Peg Doesn't Fit, the podcast that brings you the change makers in education. Tune in to hear from educational leaders who aren't content with the status quo educational model and are blazing their own path. Today we have another episode that was recorded back in spring of 2021, so we'll call it Digging Into Our Season 1 Archives. This is Chad Dumas, author of Let's Put the C in PLC, A Practical Guide for School Leaders. Check out this episode. I think you'll enjoy it.
All right, welcome Chad Dumas to the Peg Doesn't Fit. How's it going this morning, Chad?
I'm just copacetic. Thanks so much for having me on here. I'm excited for this opportunity.
Copacetic.
I haven't heard that phrase since the 90s in music. I love it.
Well, yeah. Just be sure not to confuse it with sopacetic. Just make sure that's very clear.
Well, you know, it's going to be a great interview when we start off with such a fantastic vocabulary. So let's get started. You've written this book, An Action Guide to Put the C in PLC, and I'm really excited to talk to you about that. But before we really get into putting the C back in PLC, let's discuss what a PLC is and why effective PLCs can be so powerful in a building.
Yeah. So as you know, and your listeners probably know, the idea of a PLC is jargon for professional learning community, PLC. And the research for PLCs goes back to the 60s of what it takes to effectively improve student learning. And so we've known for this 50 or 60 years that if you want to improve student learning, get the educators in the building working together to improve our practice and results for kids. And so that's what a PLC is. It's a culture, it's an ethos, it's a way of being where we as a school are working together as the adults to improve our practice and work and results for students. And the DeFores and Bob Aker kind of put that into like some specific processes. Like there's some different ways of looking at how PLCs go. I think the DeFores and Bob Aker really put it into practical terms where there's these three big ideas, and that kind of frames all work in a school that's trying to function as a professional learning community. And those three big ideas are we work together, we focus on learning, and we use our results to get better. And when we hone in on those three big ideas, and there's some other details too, but those three big ideas, that's when we are on the journey towards becoming a PLC, a professional learning community.
You know, it's crazy when you say that. Just listening to you say it, it sounds so simple. and it makes perfect sense. I mean, what better way to make sure that we're all doing the right thing and what's best for kids than to A, work together.
Yeah.
B, look at our results to see if what we're doing is working. And then D, or C, well, I forgot what letter I'm on, but then change what you're doing and make adjustments based off the results.
It's
just such common sense, but yet it's something that doesn't happen all the time.
It really is very, very common sense and simple. Unfortunately, it's not easy because there are, you know, many barriers and things that are in place in schools. The schools were not set up, you know, in the 17, 1800s to be focused on learning, to be focused on working with each other and using results, right? They were set up on this factory model where a kid comes in, the teacher teaches. We don't really pay attention to whether or not the kids learn. We just, you know, pay attention to whether or not we teach. And then, hey, at the end of 9 months, now that little widget moves on to the next grade level, right? And then we do it again with the next level. And then, hey, the widget moves on, right? So it's like this factory model of, you know, the little kids are treated like widgets until finally someday at, you know, age of 18 or ish, then we say, hey, you made it. Graduate. Hey, move on. Be successful in life. And so, because the system wasn't set up that way, that means that we have extra work to do. That it sounds simple, but it's not easy.
And that's why we started this show.
Yes, exactly.
I have a question along those lines. It sounds like Eric obviously mentioned how impressed he was at your synthesization of if that's a word, of the whole PLC idea into something good and kind of actionable and maybe, I don't know, concrete and more simple. What prompted you to take, like, did you take this book?
Yeah.
By the way, listeners, I'm holding up Learning by Doing by the DeFore cluster et al. Anyway, did you see that concept and say, I want to make it simpler and put it into action? Or what caused you to not just say, well, hey, everybody, here's the book, but I'll teach you how to do this. Instead, it sounds like you said, you know what, there is this book. However, I want to do it my way. Is that kind of what you're doing?
Yeah. So there's, what I did was, so I've been very highly influenced by the Solution Tree PLC work, very much influenced by their work. I was fortunate early on in my career, around 2000, 2001, to kind of be introduced to the PLC concept through like some articles and such. And it made sense, but I didn't get like, so what does that mean? And was blessed to be able to attend a two-day, full-day institute with Rick and Becky DeFore in Omaha, Nebraska. And those were the days where, you know, people who now go to Solution Tree Institutes, you know, there's keynotes and breakouts, they're big, they're flashy, they're amazing conferences. This was pre that. It was 2 days with just Bob and Rick and Becky. And, you know, 500 or 600 of us in a big ballroom and no breakouts, no music, no breakfast, no books for sale, just Rick and Becky for two full days. And that's where it really like, it was like, ah, this is what doing the work of a PLC is about. And so that's when I then started doing the work, and what led to my book and that work was how I was sharing with my wife the ideas earlier that we know that that this idea of building professional learning community works, and yet it doesn't happen in most schools. And I was lamenting that, why not? And my wife kept asking me, well, how do you know that principals, because principals are a linchpin in this work, how do you know that principals don't know what they need to do? And I just kept kind of pushing her aside and say, well, of course principals know, you know, they're principals, they have master's degree, they've been teachers, they know, of course they know. And finally, after her asking me 5 or 6 times, it finally occurred to me, well, maybe we don't know what we need to do. And so that's when I then combed through the research, and this was my dissertation then, was I couldn't find a list that said, look, building principal, you've got a lot going on. Here's what you need to know. Because if we know what we need to do, then we can do it. And so, you know, the DeFores and Bob Aker, they have, you know, specific PLC processes. Stiggins has assessment work. Michael Fullan is on change. You know, all these folks have all these different things as a building principal. It's all coming at you. And you're going, whoa, what do I need to actually know? And what I just did is went through all their work, of which Learning by Doing, it was pre-Learning by Doing days, but that work of Solution Tree and the DeFores and Aker and others, and pulled it all together and said, okay, building principal, out of all this, here's the 10 things that you need to know to be able to build this PLC culture. And so that's where the dissertation came in. And then about 10 years working in a high poverty, high diversity, low performing district, where we implemented these ideas. And over the course of those, over the course of 6, 7, 8 years, 5 out of 7 buildings in that district became national models for PLC work. And so it's both the research base and then the practical application of these ideas that led to, okay, let's put this down in a book, because most people aren't going to read a dissertation, but let's put it in a book where people will actually read. It's got a little bit of research, but it's also got stories and tips and checklists and additional resources to help build your knowledge so that you can then do.
Sure.
So our district, back around the time frame you were given, obviously they read the same articles because we really got into this PLC too. And the way that our district set up the PLC was, you know, some of the schools, I think the high schools maybe did a late start, but the middle schools came in early and just had that block of time. However, you know, the union gets involved and there were these negotiations and whatnot, and what that was going to look like. And our PLCs, I mean, we still have team time during the day because we're in a middle school. So that's good that we have that built in. But the PLC was exclusively supposed to be 100% teacher led, and the administration was supposed to kind of stay out of it, which in theory makes sense. In practice, I don't know if the teachers really bought into it and really, and I was a teacher back then, you know, in terms of really, truly getting in and doing the work. But how can an administrator, you know, what role do they play in the process to allow the teachers the autonomy to kind of run that show and own it and make it their own, yet still help guide the teachers to come out with a productive product?
Yeah. You're hitting on a lot of different areas here, and kind of maybe if I could just synthesize for a second, you're kind of saying, okay, so if I'm a building principal or I'm a teacher and I'm in a building where we're trying to make this, create this culture, what are like some big ideas to help move that forward?
Sure.
Yeah. So the first thing is that comes to my mind. So there's a number of things that come to my mind. The first thing is that, again, we know from more than 50 years of research that the single most influential person on a student's learning is the quality of the classroom teacher and the instructional strategies that he or she uses. That's number one. The number one factor influencing student learning. It's not the student's background. It's not the student's ethnicity. It's not their parents. It's not their community. It is the quality of the classroom teacher. Number one factor. Not to say that those other things don't impact, but the most important is the classroom teacher. Second most important is the quality of the building principal and the leadership that they provide for that school. So like that's the context, first of all, is to recognize, I think, the if you will, power that each of us has in impacting kids' learning. So that's the very first thing that comes to my mind. The second thing that comes to my mind is that you hit on this, that early on in PLC implementation, and still in many places, people think of PLC, quote unquote PLC, as a time. And it's more than that. Mm. It's a culture.
Yes.
It's a way of doing things in our building. Now, there has to be time allocated. You can't get there without time. You have to have time for the teams to meet. You have to have time designated for us to figure out what our most essential, our power standards, whatever you want to call it, that this, you know, we want kids to know and be able to do. We have to have time to figure out how we're going to find out that kids know that, you know, which assessment tools and methodologies and you know, toolkit stuff are we going to use? And then we have to have time to be able to figure out, okay, now what are we going to do with that? And who are the kids who are making it? Who are the kids who are already making it? Mm-hmm. So we can enrich for them. And how can we do this as a system? So it does take that time, but it's more than just that time. So those are like the first two considerations, but then like in terms of practical ideas. Okay, if I'm a building principal and I'm struggling with this. So first of all, recognize that it's not a time, it is a culture. And then second of all, you know, Ryan held up that amazing book, Learning by Doing. I would get that book because it is a manual for how do we go about creating this culture. And there's many nice things about that book, but it's got stories in there of here's where schools were on the journey and here's how they address things. And so you can kind of see yourself in that. There's some like rubrics or innovation configuration maps, however you want to call it, that kind of says, yeah, here's where we are. Here's where we want to go. Here's what we need to do to get there. And there's other tools in there. So I think it would be, instead of me like trying to like give you a bunch of different ideas of how to move forward, I think if a person really is struggling with this, how do we make sure that we're building this culture? I'd pick up that book and start working with my book, of course, too.
Of course.
And then, you know, start to diagnose, so to speak, where are we and where do we need to go next in building this culture?
No, I really appreciate the way that you kind of put that in perspective, because you're right. Mm-hmm. PLC might be 40 or 50 minute block once a week, mm-hmm. but that is going to be ineffective. And it's more thinking about the entire culture. What are those conversations in the hallway between classes? Do I have shared plan time? Am I willing to go next door and talk to my neighbor teacher? So thank you for putting that in context for me. And hopefully our listeners kind of grabbed onto that idea that it's not just a once a week meeting that, that we dread because it's one more thing we have to do. It's actually building a culture of something that we've talked about maybe on almost every show that we've had, collective efficacy.
Yes, yes.
And knowing that the power of collective efficacy is, you know, 1.57 effect scale. Huge effect scale to get everybody moving in the same direction. And obviously you can't move in the same direction and have that kind of impact with a 40-minute meeting once a week.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. You're right on this collective efficacy. And I would also, you know, as you were talking there, it made me think of that I heard recently that the most hated term in all of education by teachers is PLC.
Mm-hmm. You're right. Absolutely.
And it's because of this idea that we've, you know, we pigeonholed it. We've made these meetings. It's driven by an administrative an agenda. We're not, you know, it's not productive. It's not helpful. It's not impacting my practice. And so the other thing that, as you were talking, it made me think of, well, you know, if we keep doing the same thing, we're going to get the same results. So if those team meetings are ineffective, let's change them. Like it's not working. If that's the case, then let's change them. And let's think about how do we make this more effective? How do we bring people in to co-create, to co-labor, right? That's what collaboration, you know, break it up. To collaborate is to co-labor so we can make these team meetings effective as we work together. So don't keep doing it if it's not working. Let's shift some things around.
Well, I think the missing component in most of it is data. You know, success begets success. You know what I'm saying? So if the teachers can, you know, right now, maybe they do just see it as one more thing. But the bottom line is if somehow we can ensure that we have an effective system to track progress, and we can start to recognize that what we're doing is leading to student progress, well, then that's when it starts to make sense. It doesn't make sense when it's a mandate that we just have to meet. But when it starts to make a difference in the outcome of student performance and the way a teacher teaches and the way the kids receive the instruction, well, then maybe we start to buy into it because we start to realize that it's working.
Yeah.
Data. Well, it's not working for me and Ryan's my guy, but it's working for Ryan. I can say, Ryan, what are you doing differently that I'm doing that's getting such great results? And that's where the power starts to come in. So I think that is the key.
It absolutely is. You know, in God we trust, all others bring data.
Yep.
So you know, it's the linchpin. The other thing I would add in terms of data is that sometimes we get really pigeonholed into what data means. Mm-hmm. And we think that data is only the state test.
Right.
Or it's some national route. No. Data is every day.
Yes.
Like when I do an exit ticket for kids and collect those exit tickets, that's data, right? When I, you know, collect kids' work, or I do a little 5-question quiz at the end of a 3-day part of a unit, that's data. And we get together as a team and we look at it. The key, one of the keys in addition to the data, is having it be common, kind of as you referenced, so that if, you know, the 3 third grade teachers that we're asking the same exit ticket question. So when we get together, we can look at it together and see, oh, these kids have these misconceptions. These kids have these misconceptions. Now, how are we going to handle it among the 3 of us so we can address this, right? So those are the 2 things that come to my mind about data, is how important it is, but it's also, it's not just numbers, and then how we use it as a team to get better.
And Ryan, I'm gonna let you ask, because I know you got the next question, but I gotta cut in because I gotta say this, because I think if PLC is the absolute most hated phrase in education, common assessments has got to be really close behind.
And I think it's probably for a similar reason that we think of a common assessment as we just grab the test out of the book, or or, you know, some final exam. And no, assessments are happening every minute of every day. So how do we just make it common so that we can and gather the data and use it?
Yeah.
A lot of it sounds like it's mindset shifting for whatever the situation is, because these, like you're saying, these ideas that we have are actually very good things. But when we look at them as either point in time events or one more thing that I have to do instead of the way I do, I think that creates that hiccup. And I'm kind of going to go to this question with that in mind. So you said the building principle is the linchpin, and I asked, you know, what can a teacher do or a district level administrator do? And I wonder, maybe tie this into your answer. You said your book was created because building principals didn't know how to do PLCs. Is there also a hiccup for teachers? Say the building principal gets rolling, but is that like the next barrier, is that either the person above me at the district level or the teacher below me, they don't know how to not do PLC, but just make that their way of life? Yeah, answer that in however you want. I mean, I want to know what the teacher's roles are, district principals or district level's roles are, but just does it come really down to how do you go about PLC living?
Yeah. So a number of things come to mind on this idea of, So what's the role of each of these individuals within this system, right? Of individual teachers, of the groups of teachers, of the building administrator, of central office, and what are each of their roles in making this happen? And as you know, systems are complex. There is no right one answer to do it. Otherwise, that right answer would have been figured out. Sure. So having provided that disclaimer, if you will, my work has focused on the role of the leaders in this work. So we know the building print, you know, so the engine of a PLC is teams, and it is really a school level thing. The research on district level professional learning communities is really nascent. It's very early stages. And really there's a couple of areas that have really kind of come out in that research at a district level. And that is that the role of the district level is threefold. Now, let me see if I can remember them, because it's been a while since I've looked at this. But first of all, it's to limit initiatives. Mm-hmm. Too many times, district leaders will go to a conference and they'll run back. Right. And we got to do this, or we got to do that.
Yep.
The district office has to limit initiatives. And that's absolutely critical. If you want to make sure that you're building this professional learning community, that's got to happen. Number two, I think I do remember them now. Number two is to build capacity.
Okay.
So the role of the central office is not to be punitive. It's not to write people up. It's not to, there's policies that have to be administered, but it's mostly to build capacity of the building principals and teachers in the district to be able to build this community. That's got to be their primary thought process. You talked about mindset. That's got to be their mindset. And so that's where we have to shift our mindset. By the time administrators get into central office, they tend to be, because I was in the central office administrator for 10 years. We start to think of ourselves as managers, and we're not. We're capacity builders. So that's a huge shift. So number one, limit initiatives. Number two, build capacity. And then the third thing is set up systems for mutual accountability. Mm-hmm. Not a top-down accountability, but a across schools accountability. So that just like in a teacher team, we are holding each other accountable. So building principals are holding each other accountable for doing the work in their buildings. And so that those three things are what, that's kind of like, if central office folks think about themselves in those three lights, we'll move things a lot more forward. Then at the building level, the building principal, they're able to really do this work, right? And to create this culture, and they can pick up Learning by Doing or my book and a whole number of hosts of things, go to some conferences, work with their colleagues. You know, if the district office is doing that, they're going to be building capacity of the principal. They're going to be, you know, making sure that they've got the resources needed. And then as you alluded to, Ryan, like the work actually happens at the classroom level with teachers, right? With each other. And so the focus of the teachers then doesn't need to be on, you know, initiatives or these types of things. Their focus then can be on the four critical questions, because those four critical questions drive those three big ideas that I mentioned earlier. Like the three big ideas: we're going to work together, we're going to focus on learning, we're going to use our results. Well, the way we do that is we hone in on these four critical questions. And those four questions is, what do I want kids to know and be able to do? How am I going to know when they know it? What are we going to do when they don't know it? And what are we going to do when they already know it? Those four questions then drive everything. Now, there's hiccups that get in the way, right? I mean, it sounds very simple, right? You've got interpersonal dynamics, you've got tradition, you've got time barriers, you've got all these things. And I think that's where the role of the principal really comes in to help facilitate that conversation, right? So when the principal sees that a team is struggling with interpersonal dynamics, then the principal can help be the lubricant, if you will, to work through that with some of their communication skills, with things like pausing, paraphrasing, and posing questions, with helping to set up agendas, with helping teams to identify clear outcomes, with making sure that we've got timelines that work and make sense, because there has to be accountability, right? We don't just get together and do anything we want, but we need to make sure we're focused on those four questions. And the last thing I'll say, because I've been talking for a little while, but the last thing I'll say on this is, I remember Rick DeForest saying that when people asked him, how do you know if a team is productive? He would say, well, the root word of the word productive is product. So the way that we know a team is productive is through their products, mm-hmm. not by whether they like each other or whether they bring good food to their team meetings or right, whatever things you have, but it's by the products. So is the team producing what we want kids to know and be able to do? How are, right, the broken record, these four critical questions. If the team is producing these products, then we know they're being productive. All right, I rambled a long bit there, but those are a few considerations anyway.
That's why people are here. They're here to listen to you, not to us.
Yeah.
Right. The more talking you do, the better. Okay. So you talked earlier about, you know, some of the work you've done with some of those schools and how yeah. some of them have really turned it around and become nationally yeah. distinguished. Can you help connect our listeners maybe with some of those districts that are running PLCs effectively, that if they want to do some research and kind of see what that looks like, maybe name a few that are doing so?
Yeah. Time to name drop.
Yeah. The name dropper. So I was in the district I was in that when I arrived was identified as persistently lowest achieving. And then within a few years, I think 4 years, our first school was identified as a national model. And then they just started coming in after that, 5 out of 7 buildings. So that district is Hastings, Nebraska. That's in south central Nebraska, high poverty, high diversity district. And the first two buildings to become recognized as national models would be considered 90-90-90 buildings, where more than 90% of the kids are in free and reduced lunch. More than 90% of kids are, actually, I don't know. Yeah, in one building, more than 90% of kids are non-white. And yet they were able to attain more than 90% of kids proficient on benchmarks and state assessments. So I would encourage people to go look at Hastings, Nebraska. Then the other thing, broader than that though, because you know every setting is different. And so, you know, that's a fairly small town of 25,000 people, a school district of 4,000 kids, 7 buildings. If I'm coming from a place that has, you know, 100 schools, I may not care to look at Hastings. Or if I'm coming from a place where I'm just one school and we've got singletons, I may not. So the best place I think to go look is Solution Trees work. And if people go to allthingsplc.info, allthingsplc.info, they have a PLC locator. I think it's under evidence of effectiveness tab. There's an evidence of effectiveness tab and then PLC locator. And that'll tell you where are the schools in the whole country, world actually, of that are national models. And you can sort by the number of school buildings. You can sort by elementary, middle, or high school. You can sort by percent EL, you know, English learners, free and reduced lunch, whatever. You can sort so you can see, okay, where's a school that's got demographics that are as close to mine as possible, and then you can really go to there. And those schools that are on there, they want to share. They are there because they're doing the work and they're on a journey. They know they haven't arrived, but they're on this journey to build professional learning communities. And so they want to share that with others.
I really appreciate that resource, because as a teacher, as a classroom teacher, one of the things that I remember even talking about in my master's classes when I was going to be an administrator was that they'll bring in, you know, they'll show a video of model teaching, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And you're looking at that video and you're thinking, well, no wonder. Everybody's mic'd up. I mean, there's five cameras. They're getting all kinds of angles. I mean, who would ever misbehave in that kind of setting? I mean, yes, maybe that teacher is a rock star, but they're a super, super, super rock star when you have an entire production crew in there. So
yes,
being able to sort and look and check out results of districts like mine, because the other thing is I look at those kids in the classroom, I'm like, those don't look like my kids.
Right.
Exactly. You know, so it's, and that's why PLCs are so powerful.
Yes.
Because as an administrator or even an instructional coach, I can deliver a very dynamic professional development, and I can talk about all this data and I can talk about the research and try to convince teachers, but they don't believe it until they see it happening with their own kids.
Yep,
you know, and I know we're running out of time here and we don't necessarily need to go down this rabbit hole, but that's where I see the power. And I don't know if your book talks about this, but building in time for teachers to actually leave their classroom and go watch another teacher teach the same kids that they have in the same building that they're in and see how another teacher does it. So yes, they can get some ideas from that and take some of that back in their own classroom.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. I've heard the term deprivatization of practice.
I like that.
So there's another good word for the day, deprivatization of practice. And yeah, and that's part of, you know, when you create this culture, we're in each other's classes, we're observing each other. And I would take it up a level, building principals are in each other's buildings, mm-hmm, observing classrooms with each other,
yes,
and talking about what they're seeing. I mean, this is, and across districts. So it's not just within district, but across districts, that really, when we build this culture, it's far more than just at the teacher level, but it's across the entire system of having that learning from each other.
Awesome. Well, I don't know if our listeners caught this piece. I know you said it, but just one more time, if you go, we'll post this link, but that allthingsplc.info/evidence, you can search by grade level, by state, English, it says limited English. You can click a link there to see, or even enrollment size. So for anybody that's wanting to find somebody close by, sadly in Kansas, there's only one so far. And I actually used to teach there in Blue Valley District. It is a great district. But it's cool to see, like, if you're in your, whatever state you're in out there, or even what country you're in, you can say, hey, is there somebody near me? And then heck, maybe that's within driving distance where you can take a day off and go visit or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. Actually, that's one of the things I did early on with this PLC work, is I would take teams and we'd go visit other schools who were on this journey. Because, you know, as Eric was saying there, you know, my principal can say it, or I can hear it at a conference, but if I actually see teachers engaged in this work, then I start to see, oh, okay, we can do this. Because it's not rocket science. It is simple. It's not easy, but it's simple.
Right. Yep. What are some of the most exciting research that you've done, or maybe that's being done in the education industry? What's hip and new, and whatever you want to call it, cutting edge?
Hip and new. So this is probably a tough question for me, because I'm kind of the mindset that nothing is really new. Everything, you know, just comes back in different forms.
Yeah.
And so I really am fascinated by the research on interpersonal dynamics, particularly in this PLC context. Like, when you can have a person who's really skilled, highly efficacious, right? Like, individually has efficacy, and you get them together with two or three or four or five other people, and you get these four or five people are all that way. They're all skilled. They're highly efficacious. You get them together, and man, it's like a dumpster fire. because of the interpersonal dynamics. And so I'm fascinated by that research on how we work together to build community. And I think that's really powerful in some of those dynamics. And one of the more interesting studies, I think, was just from about 5 years ago, that's kind of launched some additional things, but it was from a Google study where they looked at effective teams within their own organization. And they found two characteristics of effective teams that were more important than any other characteristic that led to the success of the team. And they weren't the efficaciousness of the individuals or their skillfulness or their degrees or anything like that, or how much they liked each other, whether or not they brought brownies to meetings. It was two things. And those two things were the degree of social sensitivity of the people in the group. Like, do people read each other's cues in their nonverbals and respond accordingly? Like, I can tell that Ryan's unhappy. So do I respond accordingly? Like, do I get mad at him or do I say, hey, Ryan, will you tell me some more about what you're thinking here? Because it seems like this struck a nerve with you, right? So this degree of social sensitivity. And then the second thing is the equity of turn-taking. The degree to which participants had equitable access to providing their thinking during
Hogs
the course
and
of
logs.
Meeting. Say again?
Hogs and logs. Remember that term?
Hogs.
Float around a lot. No? We used to, you'd give talking sticks to prevent the hogs from taking over. So you could, you know, everybody would get like two coins.
Yep.
You know what I'm saying? Use them wisely, because once you use your coins, you're done talking, even though they keep talking and you have to say, no, you're done with your coins.
Yep. And that's one way to do it. And protocols are another powerful way to do it. But anyway, so that's really fascinating to me, is how do we make sure that we help people build their social understanding, reading each other's cues, and how do we help people ensure equitable turn-taking without it becoming, you know, like you said, you know, the coins or whatever that people then, you know, roll their eyes at. And now that might be something that's important. And if a team agrees on that, more power to them, go for it. So those are some areas that I think are fascinating.
Awesome.
Thank you. Hey, you talked about Nebraska. Obviously that's your home turf. And that's where, you know, you got started working with some of the school districts. Are there any other states in the U.S. that are leading the change in educational innovation outside of your hometown?
And before you answer this, maybe you already have the idea, but I'm thinking of this not only in terms of just which school districts maybe have the most people doing this or whatever, but also, is there anything you're aware of maybe at the legislative level, since we are all state run institutions, that you see, you know, this state at the legislative level is really starting to make some modifications or whatever to support some innovation?
Yeah, this is a really interesting question, because unfortunately, kind of like you said, you know, every state is different. They have their own legislature, they've only their own Department of Education. And so I wish there was more collaboration between states, because there's some incredible things going on. Like every time I go to the state of New York and look at some of their things around high quality assessment practices with like the Regents and exams, like, and things like that. And I know there's some negative connotations around that. If you just look at the assessments as assessment tools to gather information and to look at high quality learning, there's some pretty cool stuff there. Same with Massachusetts. Mississippi did some things a few years ago. I haven't stayed up on that in terms of whole level professional learning practices. The state that I've been paying most attention to recently is Arkansas. Arkansas has funded a multi-year, multi-million dollar push on this professional learning community work. And they've actually contracted with Solution Tree to identify schools who could use this support and then are doing this work to improve our practice and results for kids, and are seeing some incredible early results. I think this is the second year of that work, maybe the third year. But that, like, if people are really interested in PLC at a system level, you know, from supported at a state level, Arkansas has been one of the go-tos on that.
Awesome.
Anything out of Utah? I've noticed that Utah seems to be a little bit progressive in terms of their legislation. sorry about that. I know one of the things we've talked about, and I know it's a completely different topic, but we've really talked about a lot of competency-based learning. Mm-hmm. And it's my understanding that Utah, perhaps at this point, maybe is the only state that's passed any kind of legislation that requires state institutions to accept competency-based transcripts. Mm-hmm. So I didn't know Utah with PLCs.
That hasn't been on my radar, but it will now. I'll yeah. definitely do some digging on that.
Okay.
I also, another one that comes to mind is Washington State has done some pretty good things around leadership work. They've got the CEL model and through the University of Washington. It's kind of interesting. A lot of this work is partnered with universities and higher education when they're really, really effective.
How do you CEL, like CELL, or what's the model?
CEL.
Okay. Actually, Rob Major just referred to that. He was on our podcast too. And I listened to another of his, is that related to its teacher or leadership certification, or what is that?
They have tied it very closely to certification. Yes. And it's a leadership, they've got a teaching, an instructional model, and then they've got a leadership model. And, I'm familiar with Danielson. I'm familiar with Marzano. When I looked at the CEL stuff, for myself personally, I really liked the level of detail and ability to prompt reflective practice.
All right.
In the CEL work. Yeah.
Okay. Well, listen, Chad, we've talked about a lot of really powerful. I mean, I really think this has been a great episode, and I have enjoyed visiting with you and just picking your brain. As we wrap up, instead of Ryan and I kind of doing a closing segment where we summarize the key points, I want to give you the opportunity to maybe just process for a second everything we've talked about. Mm-hmm. And if there was one message that our teachers could come away with from this episode, what is that message that you want them to remember from this interview?
Oh, that's a fantastic question. Like a good old summarizing strategy, right? So at the very end, where are we? As a good teacher does, right? Summarize our experiences for this mm-hmm. last 30, 40 minutes. I guess I would summarize it into maybe two big ideas. That the first is we have to work together. That none of us knows enough by ourselves to reach every kid. And so we have to work together. It's incumbent upon us. It's obligatory. There's no choice. We have to work together if we're going to meet the needs of every kid, and we need to meet the needs of every kid. So that's the first thing. And the second thing is that we can do it. It's been proven time and time again. It works. So let's go do it.
Wow.
Love it.
Love it as well. Thank you so much for coming on our show today. It has been an honor. And we know that you're a busy man, and the fact that you gave up a little bit of your time to come visit with us is really appreciated. And we just want to thank you so much for your time.
My absolute pleasure. Thank you so very much. Anytime.
That was a great episode with Chad Dumas. If you're interested in learning more, obviously you got to read his book. You can find it on Amazon, I believe in Barnes & Noble. I got lucky enough to get sent a free copy. Heck yeah, and it is truly inspiring. Please give it a read. Also, follow him on Twitter. As he said, reach out. He'd be happy to respond to you. And tune in next week where we have another author set, actually this time. We have the authors of Learning That Transfers. Definitely check that out, and we look forward to seeing you next time.